This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, November 24, 2025. I'm Mark Stangle from Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Today's first article is a Christian Science perspective from Camille Karandang. It's entitled, Gratitude Fueled Love. My first Thanksgiving in Boston, I was an ocean away from my home. One of my managers at work invited me to join their family for Thanksgiving. While I gratefully accepted, I was also nervous. What if I didn't get along with everyone? My trepidations were laid to rest as soon as I entered their house. I wasn't treated like a stranger. Instead, I was immediately embraced with utmost love and care. On the surface, we didn't have much in common, yet I felt at home. The Bible lesson for Thanksgiving Day from the Christian Science Quarterly opens with, Blessed be the Lord, who daily loadeth us with benefits, even the God of our salvation. This psalm praises God for filling our lives with good, and this experience showed me that one way to tangibly feel God's care is through the kindness of others. In this lesson, a passage from Mary Baker Eddy's Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures says, Are we really grateful for the good already received? Gratitude is much more than a verbal expression of thanks. Action expresses more gratitude than speech. And later we read, To keep the commandments of our Master and follow His example is our proper debt to Him and the only worthy evidence of our gratitude for all that He has done. When we think of gratitude this way, it expands to an act of love. The two great commandments that Jesus gave us are to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. It's easy to cherish the good we've received, but gratitude to God also impels us to give. Christian Science teaches us that God's Spirit is one in all, the creator of every one of us, His holy spiritual image. What a gift to realize that we are God's reflection, divine love's children, receiving so much good from God, the sole source of good. As we understand this, it helps us express love toward others in ways that touch their hearts. A simple act of gratitude can break the spell of feeling that we are distant from God. Before Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, he gave thanks to God. He said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that thou hearest me always. This models for us that we can express gratitude not only for blessings already realized, but also for future good, and not only for ourselves, but also for others. Such grateful expectancy is the fruit of understanding that the source of all unchanging good is God. So then we shouldn't just give thanks and call it a day. A simple act of kindness, especially when impelled by prayer, can show God's love to another. Since that first Thanksgiving in Boston, I've kept an open door to those who need to feel that embrace, during Thanksgiving and beyond. As Jesus said, Freely ye have received, freely give. We can be grateful every day that goodness is within our grasp to experience and express. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, November 24, 2025, comes from Kendra Norton-Beto. She's a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. Her article is entitled, Cranberries, So Much More Than Meets the Eye. Sometimes the best stories can be found in your own backyard, like the Massachusetts cranberry harvest that I wrote about for this week's cover story. Like many Americans, I associate cranberries with the holidays. My mom made cranberry relish from scratch, sweetened with orange juice and pulp, and a hint of maple syrup. Its tartness offered a balance to the richness of a traditional Thanksgiving dinner. She also served a festive old-fashioned drink called cranberry shrubs with Christmas dinner, filling shallow crystal goblets with the red juice and a drop of lime sherbet. When I moved to Massachusetts after college and a childhood of living in many parts of the country, I became aware that cranberries played a significant role in this local history and culture. Some friends and I once traveled to Nantucket by ferry for the annual holiday stroll. the warmly lit shops offered treats as we hunted for gifts. I still remember biting into a soft oatmeal cookie and discovering the delightful pairing of chocolate, dried cranberries, and cinnamon. As a way to get to know my neighbors, I baked and gifted small loaves of cranberry orange bread filled with crunchy roasted walnuts wrapped in silver foil and tied with red and green ribbon. Once I tried to string a garland of popcorn and cranberries for my tiny apartment Christmas tree, but gave up, discouraged by the tediousness of the task. But had I ever seen a cranberry in the wild? I wasn't sure. So when I learned this year that some cranberry farmers in Massachusetts offered tours of their bogs during harvest times, I signed up right away. There is something ridiculous about the sight of people standing in water surrounded by millions of bobbing red berries. You've probably seen the commercials. Two actors portraying ocean spray, cranberry farmers stand in waders hip deep in a cranberry bog, dryly cracking jokes in the way that only New Englanders can. Is a foodie who likes cranberry juice actually a juicy? Why would anyone pay money to wade in a cranberry bog? The answer is simple. Something about the vibrant red of the berries and the way they roll in sheer abundance makes our fears and worries feel outnumbered. When staff photographer Melanie Stetson Freeman and I squished into the bog, we found ourselves hugged by cranberries on all sides. We laughed and laughed, throwing fitfuls of them into the air like confetti. It felt like a celebration. Of what? It's hard to say exactly. Gratitude for this abundant gift from the earth? Maybe it was just a feeling of being alive and full of joy. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, November 24, 2025, is the cover story by Kendra Norton Beto, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. It's entitled, Wading Through the Crimson Bogs. In Massachusetts, the cranberry harvest endures, a splash of red resilience amid shifting tides of change. Equus Trundy, wearing a black and red buffalo check shirt and a sturdy pair of boots, takes her spot in front of 30 people at the edge of a cranberry bog in Carver, Massachusetts. Welcome to Red Meadow Farm, she says into a headset. I am a cranberry farmer. The crowd bursts into applause. It's a bluebird sky October afternoon. This is the third group of tourists who have paid up to $80 each for an opportunity to learn about the annual cranberry harvest. Soon they will put on waders and squish through a flooded bog bobbing with crimson berries. The Red Meadow weekend tours are so popular that they sell out before the end of the month. We tried for several years to try to catch the cranberry harvest season, but we did not make it, says Juan Lee Young, who traveled down from Boston with her husband, Gerald Klickstein, for Red Meadow's Wade in the Bog tour. Ms. Leong, who grew up in Malaysia, finds the cranberry somewhat exotic, but has grown to love its tart juice. Of course, the first introduction of cranberry to me as a Malaysian is, you eat it with turkey, right? The reaping of the Massachusetts state berry is as much a cherished autumnal backdrop in Carver as the landscape trimmed in hues of red, gold, and burnt umber, or the Renaissance booth at the local King Richard's Fair. And cranberry dishes, of course, are often staples of traditional Thanksgiving feast. Watching the watery cranberry harvest is a visually stunning experience. At other times of the year, bogs appear as scruffy meadows, their berries unseen beneath low-lying vines that stretch across acidic, sandy soils. But for a few brief weeks each fall, as the bogs become flooded fields, the berries emerge to dance in swirls of changing shapes. They are gathered together into floating, bordered rings, vacuumed up into trucks, and then carted away to be processed. Cape Cod cranberries have as much of a storied place in the United States founding narrative as the native Wampanoag and the settling English. They are one of a number of iconic regional crops, like Florida oranges and Vermont maple syrup, that are associated with the culture and flavor of a place. Cranberries are indigenous to North America, and the United States and Canada produce about 98% of the global supply. Chile has recently become a significant grower, and countries such as Belarus, Azerbaijan, and Ukraine are among other nations producing a small amount of commercially grown cranberries. but the number of bogs producing the tart berry in Massachusetts is dropping, as are its prices. Once considered the cranberry capital of the world, Massachusetts has seen its production outpaced by Wisconsin for the past 30 years. It's now also squeezed by rising production in eastern Canada. Today, a growing number of Massachusetts farmers are closing operations and using state funds to convert their bogs to wetlands. And yet, there are signs of resilience and cooperation and even joy among the roughly 300 farmers left in the Bay State. They are fierce defenders of a vocation and a crop they treasure. Some are installing solar panels, developing new products, and running agritourism events to increase their revenue. Others are undergoing costly renovations to their century-old bogs to make them more water-efficient and planting higher-yielding hybrid varieties. Still others are committed to preserving heritage berries as part of Massachusetts' identity. I've been very fortunate where I've been able to build a career doing what I love, says John Mason, a second-generation cranberry farmer and carver. But it's changing, and it's changing faster than any of us expected it to do. In contrast with current market forces driving change, the Massachusetts cranberry has had an unhurried history. One of North America's three commercially grown native fruits, it's emerged in the marshy lowlands carved out by retreating glaciers 12,000 years ago. Alternating layers of sand and organic matter allow for good drainage while retaining moisture, spurring the vines to spread across Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. The Wampanoag people gathered the tart Samanoonish, their name for wild cranberries, for medicinal purposes. They also used the fruit to enhance dishes of squash, corn, beans, and game. They beat the berries into a paste that was mixed with fat and dried meat to create pemmican, an early kind of protein bar that could keep for years. When the English settled in Massachusetts in the 1600s, they were quick to adapt the cranberry into their diet. The British fenberry and gooseberry, close cousins to the cranberry, were traditionally stewed with sugar and served with meat and poultry. Some historical accounts suggest the English named the sour and astringent fruit craneberry, since the blossom's color and shape resembled the crimson-capped head of the sandhill crane. The harvest of wild cranberries was so prolific in the Massachusetts Bay Colony that barrels were sent from Boston to appease King Charles II in 1677. But the father of the cultivated cranberry is purportedly Captain Henry Hall, who was said to be present at the Battle of Bennington in 1777 when the tide turned against the Redcoats in the Revolutionary War. As a retired sea captain on Cape Cod, he noticed something unusual in 1816. A wild-growing cranberry patch, half buried by sand, showed an abundance of berries the following spring. Soon after, he fenced off a cranberry yard and set to work cultivating the crop. He eventually started putting his yield into the barrels and shipping them to New York. His success inspired others to carve out their own cranberry yards. In 1821, Boston journalist William Tudor penned an essay, Memoir on Cranberry Sauce. He noted that cranberry sauce, vulgarly called cranberry sauce, from the voracious manner in which they eat it, was so abundant in the region that formal dinners often featured four soup plates of the sauce at four corners of the table. Marcus Uran, a lawyer turned farmer known as Mr. Cranberry, started experimenting with canning cranberry sauce in 1912. He later founded the Ocean Spray Company in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Today, 700 farmers from Massachusetts, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Washington, Canada, and recently Chile sell their berries to Ocean Spray as part of its cooperative. Wisconsin, with its ample, affordable acres, perfected building efficient square bogs in the 1960s and planted hybrid varieties. Farmers there also employed the techniques of wet harvesting, and they soon leapfrogged Massachusetts to the front of the industry. The vast majority of cranberries are turned into juice, made palatable for those unaccustomed to its tart taste by combining it with other fruit juices, such as apple, grape, or pear. only 5% of cranberries are harvested to be sold as whole berries. In 1993, Ocean Spray introduced dried, sweetened cranberries, which gave the industry a needed boost. The state's number one agricultural product, the cranberry, as well as its related industries, contributed a total of $1.7 billion to the Massachusetts economy in 2022, according to Farm Credit East, a regional agribusiness cooperative. Last month, Governor Mara Healey declared October Massachusetts Cranberry Month as a way to promote local growers and encourage consumers to buy Massachusetts-grown cranberries and cranberry products. But the industry needs to innovate to stay relevant and competitive, experts say. Massachusetts cranberries, once the industry leader, now make up only about 27% of the nation's total crop. 10 years ago, the state convened a revitalization task force to map out paths to renovate existing bogs, adapt new technologies, and establish green exit strategies. Under those guidelines, farmers who want to retire or offload unproductive bogs without selling to developers can instead convert their land to wetlands with the help of the state. So far, Massachusetts has converted 9 bogs into wetlands at a cost of $27 million, with 11 more planned. It's so much the fabric of southeastern Massachusetts. If we were to lose that, we'd be losing a lot of cultural as well as economic and environmental benefits, says Brian Wick, executive director of the Cape Cod Cranberry Growers Association, who worked on the task force. He's encouraged by the number of farmers who are renovating their bogs and experimenting with new varieties and income streams to stay afloat. Not everyone can be a farmer, says Mr. Wick. You need to be stubborn, but you also need that ability to adapt and learn. That's the genetic makeup of a cranberry grower. Mr. Mason, the second-generation grower, has wanted to be a cranberry farmer ever since he started picking next to his father as a tot. He has fond memories of dry harvesting cranberries with his fathers. He loved walking behind a picker that combed through the vines, depositing the berries into a box. As he grew older, he recruited friends on the soccer team to help lump the berries into bags. But his parents had other plans. They didn't want me thinking 9 acres of cranberry farm was going to be like a career, Mr. Mason says. They sent me to private school and they wanted me to do my own thing, and I came clawing back. His life, in fact, is now completely dedicated to the cranberry. He is an assistant general manager at AD Makepeace Company, the largest cranberry growing company in the world. And as the owner of Tilson Brook Cranberry, the farm he grew up on in Carver, he is a member of the Ocean Spray Cooperative. He's also currently the president of the Cape Cod Cranberry Growers Association and sits on the board of the Cranberry Research Foundation. As a farm owner, he first worked to make his 100-year-old dry harvested bogs more efficient. He stripped out the old vines, added new sand, and planted Haynes berries, a higher-yield hybrid developed at Rutgers University in New Jersey. He squared the edges of the bogs to make them easier to mow and installed new underground irrigation systems that draw water from a nearby pond. He laser leveled the bogs so they require a lot less water to flood, and he monitors them with a meter. For this business to be sustainable and have the luster for the next generation, it needs to make money, Mr. Mason says. As I enjoy this, there aren't enough crazy people out there who enjoy it as much as I do it for nothing. Inside the Edgewood Bogs Cranberry Processing Facility in Carver, things are hopping. Fresh cranberries are bebopping across a series of bounce board separators and conveyor belts. They are washed and blow-dried, preparing them for packaging as Cape Cod Select berries. Berries that bounce are best because they will hold their form during shipping. Soft berries are sorted out to be turned into juice and other products. Legend has it that the bounce principle was discovered by a New Jersey cranberry farmer named John Pegleg Webb in the 1840s. Pegleg Webb stored his berries on the second floor of a barn. Instead of trying to carry full barrels of cranberries down the steps, he simply tipped them over and let the berries pour down. Firm berries hopped skipped to the bottom, while the inferior soft ones schlumped. Cindy Rhodes is a contemporary innovator. She married a third-generation cranberry farmer, and all three of her grown sons are part of the family business, Edgewood Boggs. Ms. Rhodes and her husband, Matt, took control of the family business in 2005, a bad year for cranberries. We essentially had to borrow money to pay our borrowed money, she says. So when cranberry prices boomed again in 2008, she knew she had to act to improve the business. For years, I couldn't understand why you couldn't find cranberries at the grocery store when you can find every other food imaginable, she says. She and her husband invested in market research and determined that there was indeed an opportunity in frozen cranberries beyond Thanksgiving. They then launched a new brand, Cape Cod Select. After some trial and error, Ms. Rhodes brought her product to a natural organic food expo in 2010, and a major grocery store distributor immediately expressed interest. Shaw's was the first retailer to really notice my product, and the buyer was in love with it, she says. He actually showed me all the ropes of how to work with retail. Cape Cod Select now grows 6 million pounds of cranberries each year and has a diverse product line, which includes fresh and frozen cranberries sold at 6,000 stores nationwide. That's in addition to bulk wholesale sales. Each bag features recipes for smoothies, baked goods, and overnight oats to help consumers imagine other uses for whole cranberries, like cranberry squares. Even with continual adaptation and innovation, however, it is challenging to survive in a market saturated with cranberries. You can't make it on today's prices, says Ms. Rhodes. We're fortunate we got this other retail outlet. But with today's prices in the cranberry industry, it costs more to grow them than what they are paying us. Kathy Rutter, curator of multi-century experiences at Plymouth Patuxent Museums in Plymouth, Massachusetts, often deals with tourist questions about the cranberry harvest when she is in character from the 1600s. I get a lot of questions that are hard to answer dressed like a pilgrim, says Ms. Rutter. They are asking about, you know, the sand and the flooding. And so I finally just have to say, well, we just kind of pick them when it's time to pick them. Ms. Rutter credits Sarah Josepha Hale, a 19th century writer and activist who wrote endlessly about New England harvest traditions. She campaigned for a national Thanksgiving Day, linking cranberry sauce and turkey to the holiday's mythology. Hale also wrote the nursery rhyme, Mary Had a Little Lamb. There are more than 100 varieties of cranberries, and like apples, they have different sizes, shapes, colors, and tastes. While more than half of Massachusetts cranberry farmers have switched to higher-yielding varieties, some farmers remain dedicated to cultivating heirloom varieties. At Red Meadow Farm, the Trundies grow heritage cranberries native to Massachusetts. The house variety is tart, sour, and slightly astringent, and has a firm texture. The early black variety is smaller and darker with a fresh, crisp flavor. Both of them are derived from cuttings of wild cranberries discovered and cultivated in the 1800s. We're really excited about our heritage vines, not only because they are wild-type native plants from this area, but because, honestly, they taste really good, says Ms. Trundy. She and her husband, Jordan, bought the 17.5 acres that make up Red Meadow Farm in 2020. Both had worked as technology professionals in Boston, but during the pandemic's upheaval, they took a leap to become first-generation growers. The harvest is their busy season, as the last cranberry farm downstream on the Wallowayantic River, they patiently wait for their turn to dam its waters and flood their bogs. Like every other farm during a wet harvest, they knock the tiny red fruit from the vines with a picket machine. Inside each cranberry are four tiny air chambers that keep the berries afloat. Then the berries are corralled with a boom and vacuumed up with a large hose. Extended family members take time off from other jobs to help harvest the fruit, outfit and photograph tourists, and run the farm stand. Equus is listed as the full-time cranberry farmer, while Jordan still treks into the city 3 times a week to continue working in the tech field, providing a necessary income stream to support farm operations. as a symbiotic relationship. Farmers are a lot like IT people in the sense that they are just problem solvers, says Mr. Trundy. The other main income stream comes in the form of joyful tourists frolicking in the bog. They pose with rakes, gleefully toss cranberries into the air, and take cheek-to-cheek selfies. Nati Punina, who grew up in Russia, loved the experience of wading into the bog with her husband, Nick Makridikas, who is from Greece, and their two young children, Alex and Anastasia, to pose for photos. They grow this tart berry in Russia, but you don't get to do this, she says, gesturing toward the bog. It's a real New England tradition. The tours are a huge moneymaker for the Trundys. In fact, the tours make five times what the Trundys will earn from selling their crop, says Mr. Trundy. After the tours are over, these berries will be composted and spread on a wildflower field rimmed with beehives. Red Meadow sells the honey at its farm stand. This probably represents the happiest part of the harvest process, says Ms. Trundy. You finish all the hard work, and now you just get to stand there and watch it go into the pump. It definitely feels the most rewarding when you're standing in a circle surrounded by all of your years' hard work. Your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, November 24, 2025, continues with this following article. It's entitled, Creating a Future After Losses of Husband and Home. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Allie Martin. The women on stage bow to applause, celebrating a moment of triumph. These dancers have completed their summer showcase 8 months after dozens of families at the West Side School of Ballet lost homes in the Los Angeles wildfires. Connie Bell glides out to center stage with the rest of her cohort, beaming with joy and relief. She stands with perfect posture, her hair pulled into a neat bun, wearing a forest green leotard and matching mesh skirt that floats when she moves. Ms. Bell has been dancing her way through heartache. In December, her husband died after a long illness. A month later, the Palisades fire incinerated their Malibu home. She and Ed had been together for 45 years and raised a family in that little house at the edge of the Pacific Ocean. Now, as she puts it, she is back where she was as a young adult. That was the last time she was on her own, with no place she called home, no family or career to drive her decisions, with limited resources and unlimited choices. The stakes are high, financially and emotionally. The loss of the house comes with deep sadness. Rebuilding might be out of reach. Thousands of people like Ms. Bell have been confronting the same decisions, sell or build, forge a new life, or try to reclaim the old. The Pasadena and Altadena wildfires caused unprecedented loss in the L.A. area. More than 16,000 structures destroyed, three-fourths of which were homes. Recovery is slowly getting underway across the county. The labyrinth of housing permits, government benefits, and insurance payouts is daunting. But for some, the destruction has also created a clearing, an opportunity to reevaluate and reset. Ms. Bell is taking it. She has discovered that heartbreak and joy can coexist, even when a person is grieving, she says. There are also times to laugh and be alive and have joy. Those things don't go away. January, just Connie. On January 7, with hurricane-force winds driving fire toward the coast and smoke blackening out the sky, Ms. Bell grabbed just a few things. Cyrus, the family parrot, enough clothing for an overnight stay, and her ballet slippers. She had lived most of her life in the small oceanside city, where wildfires and evacuations come with the landscape. I didn't really feel like I was in any danger, but I just felt like staying wasn't the right thing for me to do, she says. Nearly 250,000 people were under evacuation orders that night, including Ms. Bell, who took refuge with her daughter and son-in-law in L.A. By morning, everything was gone. Clothes, furniture, photos, mementos, all the evidence of her family's life together. With everything upended, she found structure and purpose in the ballet studio. 2 days into the fires, Ms. Bell was back in class. Ballet, she says, sort of saved me. She has been dancing since childhood, through college, then professionally, and as a ballet teacher. Today, she takes adult classes at Westside in Santa Monica. In that room, she is just Connie, says Charlie Hodges, her instructor. Being happy and complete in the studio, he adds, showed her that she could be those things elsewhere. February, home for now. A few weeks after the fires were contained, Ms. Bell has moved into a condominium that her daughter owns in Santa Monica. She is staying there with Cyrus and a bulldog named Otis, who made his way into Ms. Bell's care after his owner died unexpectedly. She and the dog relate to each other, she says. What she lacks in stability, she makes up for with resolve. Ms. Bell is ready to embrace a new chapter and sell her property. She's not alone. In the first 6 months after the fires, a surge of lots hit the market. More than 170 were sold in Altadena, compared with 6 in the first half of 2024. In the Palisades, it was 94, 1 the year before. Ms. Bell's reasons for selling are mostly financial. In this part of California, where property values and cost of living are among the highest in the country, she could make enough from the empty lot to retire in modest comfort. And the thought of rebuilding without Ed feels like too much. Of the house, she says, I just don't have any more room for that. The days are stacked with checklists, phone calls, and paperwork. Her lot needs to be clear of debris, and there are codes and filing deadlines to piece together. The trust for her estate burned, so she needs to track that down. Amid those tasks, there is also delight. Allegra, her daughter, is having a child soon. It'll be Ms. Bell's first grandchild. She is creating her plan by focusing on what she loves. I'm refreshing myself, she says, and I hope that I can be happy. I want to be happy. March, sunshine and rainbows and realism. In late March, Ms. Bell is still waiting for a sofa to be delivered, the missing piece in a living area that's starting to feel like home, with a fluffy white rug, round metal coffee table, and Otis sprawled on the floor. Cyrus squawks from his large cage. She is balancing familiar habits, like ballet, with the newness of recovery. Her resources are limited, but not her persistence. There's confidence that whatever she gets hit with, she's going to have the strength and the intelligence, the creativity to prevail, says Beth Friedman, a longtime friend. Built in 1946 on an iconic stretch of California waterfront, the house she shared with her husband was a far cry from the celebrity mansions that Malibu is known for today. The income she made as an Airbnb superhost helped pay the costs that come with waking up to ocean waves and dolphins. Ed and Connie bought the house in 2002, when their two children were not yet teenagers. For a time, the four of them shared just one bedroom, their beds lined up side by side like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, says son Colburn. The close quarters inside were offset by an expanse of sun and ocean outside. The house hovered over sand on support beams lapped by the ocean tide. It was, Colborn says, a perfect place. Protecting it was a priority. Ms. Bell is properly insured, unlike thousands of homeowners who have been caught in the state's insurance crisis. Between 40% and 80% of homes lost in the wildfires are underinsured, according to a state agency. The largest insurers have been pulling out of California for the last few years due to increasing environmental risks and the rising cost of rebuilding. Many homeowners have been forced onto the state's FAIR plan, a syndicate of companies required to offer fire policies to homeowners left behind by the traditional marketplace. Those policies are more expensive and offer limited coverage. Ms. Bell's insurance covers 3 years' worth of living expenses, plus a payout for the 800-square-foot house. Selling the lot comes with security and retirement. Rebuilding, which could net her more if she sold later, would take everything she has plus some. It would also take years of managing building codes and construction details. Yet selling comes with unknowns. What will the glut of lots do to the value of her land? The longer it sits, the more her imagination fills in the property, edging out the financial realities of rebuilding. before the ruins are cleared, she returns to the place that framed her life and loves for 23 years. Ms. Bell finds poetry in the wreckage, pointing out the warped roofing panels that look like handkerchiefs and the mangled antique iron bed frame draped like a piece of lace. Tragedy has not corrupted her view. A mix of New York realism learned from her parents, says her son, and the 1960s California hippie culture she grew up in. Things go on and things must continue, says Coburn. But also for her, everything is kind of sunshine and rainbows. She has a multiplicity to her that is in contrast, but at the same time, I think, is useful. April and May, a new vision. By mid-May, her cream-colored couch is finally in place, along with end tables and a lamp. A TV hangs on the wall. Ms. Bell, Otis, and Cyrus are starting to have a routine. When grief creeps in, she focuses on what was not lost. My husband feels like love now, she says, and my family, and my community. Those things no one will ever take from you. Spring has brought some setbacks. Her neighbor's properties have been cleared by the Army Corps of Engineers. She hired a private contractor, but the person disappeared. Worse than the $1,000 she lost is the hit to her confidence. She appealed to the county but missed the deadline to sign back up for the Corps. She didn't know who to trust, she says, and she didn't trust herself. Despite that, she doesn't languish in distress. It's not like I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's just been a little bit harder getting there than it should have been, she says. That churning fuels more what-ifs. Late-night musings are giving shape to a new vision. In place of an empty lot, Ms. Bell imagines building a jewel box on the water's edge. She is in touch with an architect who specializes in buildings made of glass. The lot is too small for a family home, she says, so she'll make it a work of art. Maybe to sell, maybe not. Her children do not agree about her change of heart. Allegra thinks she should sell the lot as soon as possible. Invest the money and live my life, says Ms. Bell. Coburn, on the other hand, has pushed for a rebuild. Not only would the house create a legacy for their family, he says, but he believes the project would help his mom realize a new lease on life. It already has. Ms. Bell is exploring plans and permits, which she believes will add to the property's value. It is a business decision as well as a creative one, she says, even if she is not quite sure how she'll pay for it. Art in step with logic. August and after, joy in the art of it. In early August, Ms. Bell sits quietly in the garden at a Santa Monica bakery. She and her fellow dancers wrapped their valet showcase 2 days earlier. The weeks of practice deepened their camaraderie, she says, just as she had hoped. Now she feels wonderfully and creatively liberated. Her teacher, Mr. Hodges, sees someone recovering with grace and grit. She's not trying to recreate the life she had, but she's trying to respond to that and build a life that's next. What's next now is rebuilding. Geologists and structural engineers will help Ms. Bell and some neighbors build foundations on the beach. Architects will deliver plans for her new home. There is joy in the art of it and an expectation that whatever she chooses will be right for her and for the property, and so that's all a beautiful thing. I feel like there's so many wonderful things to live and be and do, she says. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, November 24, 2025, comes from the Global Current section. It's entitled, Seeking Minerals, Trump Tries Deal-Making and Peacemaking in Eastern Congo. And this article is written by contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Theodore de Queiroz. Along the ripped flanks of the Rubaya Hills in the northeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo, hundreds of workers dig through one of the world's largest concentrations of coltan, a mineral that fuels both the 21st century economy and one of its longest-running conflicts. It does not matter to them, they say, who controls these mines. It could be the Congolese government, which has struggled for decades to assert authority from a capital city some 1,600 miles away. It could be one of the militias tied to neighboring Rwanda, which took control of the swath of Congo last year. Or it could be the United States, which this summer brokered a peace agreement between Congo and Rwanda, a first step United States officials have said to an economic agreement that could help Americans move into a minerals market long dominated by Chinese companies. In Rubaya, we dig for whomever is in charge, says a young miner named Amani, as he emerges from a dark tunnel wearing a headlamp. In this particular spot, that means Panchalain Mtuzi, who runs one of the access points into the 7,400-acre mining site. He has been mining the area for 15 years and knows the value of his leased 2,000 or so square foot plots. It's an incredibly rich place, a paradise for a farmer, says Mr. Mtuzi, who paid nearly $20,000 for his last plot, more than 540 times the monthly salary of a rural Congolese person. In 1 week, you can make your investment profitable. The whole hill is mineralized. It's a bounty that has attracted President Donald Trump, who has put a priority on rebuilding American access to and processing of critical minerals. These are minerals that the United States Geological Survey describes as essential for national security and modern-day technology, but which currently have a vulnerable supply chain. The Trump administration has invested heavily in international mineral projects from Canada to Southeast Asia. Here, he sees the potential for a double win, both as a dealmaker and a peace builder. But the realities on the ground in one of the geologically richest and most troubled regions in the world show just how complicated extending this effort to Congo may be. In 2023, Congo supplied 40% of the world's tantalum, an essential mineral found in coated rock and used in key industries, such as telecommunications, defense, and aerospace. Approximately one-fourth of this production comes from the Rubaya mines. It takes 3 hours along a narrow mud road shaped by frequent heavy rains to reach the mining site from the city of Goma, the capital of Congo's North Kivu province. In the decades since the 1994 Rwandan genocide set off a regional conflict here, hundreds of armed militias have fought over the territory. The conflict has displaced more than 7 million people, including more than 100,000 since the beginning of this year alone. Some, like the powerful Congo River Alliance, the AFC, which includes the prominent March 23 movement rebel group, M23, are connected to the Tutsi ethnic group that was murdered during the genocide and now rules Rwanda. This group seized large swaths of territory in the region in 2021, pledging to eradicate the remains of Hutu militia that took refuge in this part of Congo soon after the genocide. In April 2024, it took the Rubaya mines. Before that, the area was held by another group called Wazalendo, or Patriots in Swahili. This was an auxiliary of the Congolese army and had a practice of pillaging Rubaya's riches, according to miners there. They paid themselves by stealing bags of minerals from us, says Mr. Mtuzi. He says he is pleased by the new group in charge. The AFC M23 doesn't do that. Our prayer is that they stay in Rubaya. But even that sentiment belies the violent complications of this region. Mr. Mtuzi is Kinyarwanda speaking and shares an ethnic background with the Tutsi warlords. The United States Department of the Treasury has set sanctions on the militias, specifically citing their involvement in what are often called conflict minerals. Even with its unrest, Congo attracts the highest amount of mineral exploration in Africa, around $130.7 million in 2024, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Much of this investment comes from China. Chinese companies have long operated in eastern Congo, and some analysts say they have exploited the conflict and warring groups for economic advantage. Chinese firms have equity in 15 of the country's 19 copper and cobalt projects and control 80% of cobalt production. Two American companies also opened production in the region this year, including Cobold Metals, which is backed by billionaires Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, and has negotiated an agreement to acquire a stake in the Manono lithium deposits south of Rubaya. But regardless of the international owners, militia groups benefit from mining here. The AFC M23, for instance, makes no secret of profiting from the mines under its control. The mining business continues as it always has. To say that we benefit from it, obviously, why don't you ask the question of if we benefit from agriculture, says Cornel Nanga, the coordinator of the movement's political branch, during a meeting this past April in his new headquarters in Goma. But that money does not only stay with the militia group, analysts say. A United Nations investigation found that ore from the Rubia mine is regularly transported into Rwanda and enters a global smuggling network. Smugglers will often buy fake certifications for their products to launder them into ethical mineral supply chains, including those that end up in the United States, according to investigators. We need to bring everyone to the table, not just the Rwandans and the Congolese, but also the Burundians, Ugandans, Tanzanians, and all the stakeholders who profit from the diversion of minerals from Eastern DRC, says Zobel Bahalal, senior researcher with the Global Initiative think tank. The three decades old conflict will need more than deadlines to be solved. Analysts say the United States is signaling that it will punish those involved in destabilizing the peace process in eastern Congo, which is a prerequisite for any agreement on Congolese minerals. Still, despite diplomatic pressure and the July ceasefire signed in Doha, Qatar, between Congo and the M23 under American mediation, fighting has resumed in eastern Congo. American diplomatic levers are not enough to stop the violence, says Paul Simon Handy, regional director of the Institute for Security Studies based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Donald Trump was to be the president who resolves conflicts without sending ground troops. Next, in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, November 24, 2025, is an article from the Explainer section of the Christian Science Monitor. It's entitled, Presidents Rarely Use the Insurrection Act. Here's how Trump might invoke it. As court battles have intensified around President Donald Trump's efforts to deploy National Guard troops in United States cities, he's weighing another option that could allow him to significantly expand the military's domestic presence. Invoking the centuries-old Insurrection Act could give the president wider latitude to send the military into states over the objections of local officials and allow those troops to take a more active role than National Guard troops are permitted now. Mr. Trump's controversial threats to use the act, which is meant for cases of insurrection or rebellion, come as the administration encounters legal and political challenges to its efforts to involve the National Guard in a campaign against crime and illegal immigration. The president and his team appear to see the Insurrection Act as a potential way to sidestep the legal cases slowing his plans down. The administration's deployment of National Guard troops to Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Memphis, and attempts to send service members to Chicago and to Portland, Oregon, have resulted in lawsuits from most of those cities and from the states of California, Illinois, and Oregon. Multiple federal districts and appellate courts have temporarily halted Mr. Trump's plans or have ruled against him. And the United States Supreme Court is weighing whether to respond to an emergency appeal from the Trump administration asking it to permit a deployment in Chicago. Separately, on November 7, a federal judge in Oregon issued a permanent injunction blocking the president from deploying the National Guard in Portland. The administration is expected to appeal this decision as well. Here's a look at what the Insurrection Act says and how President Trump could use it. First question, what is the Insurrection Act? The Insurrection Act, passed in 1807, allows the president to deploy the military to suppress a rebellion or enforce the rule of law in emergencies. It is the main exception to the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, another law that normally forbids members of the military from carrying out domestic law enforcement tasks such as arresting civilians. Presidents have generally treated the Insurrection Act as an option to be used rarely, yet some scholars worry the law's ambiguity opens the door for greater use. The law has three sections outlining different scenarios in which the president can deploy troops. One is if a state governor requests these troops. Another is if the president determines courts are no longer functioning in a state to enforce federal law. The third and broadest condition allows the president to deploy the military to a state if a situation there is causing some people to be deprived of their constitutional rights, and if state or local authorities aren't able to enforce those rights. The president could do this even if a state's governor objects. The Insurrection Act is different from martial law, which generally means imposing military law on civilians. Troops deployed under the Insurrection Act still have to obey regular United States laws and can only arrest people who are breaking those laws. It does not give the president complete power, says Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. The Insurrection Act does not change what is legal and what isn't legal. However, the law does give the president considerable flexibility. Unlike some other emergency laws, the Insurrection Act does not come with a time limit or any requirement to consult Congress. Next question, when has it been used? United States presidents have used the Insurrection Act 30 times, ranging from the country's early days to the late 20th century, according to an analysis by the Brennan Center for Justice. George Washington used a precursor of the act in 1792 to suppress an uprising known as the Whiskey Rebellion, and Abraham Lincoln used it when Southern states seceded from the Union at the start of the Civil War. In 1957, Dwight Eisenhower sent members of the 101st Airborne Division to protect 9 black high school students from racial violence as they attend classes in Little Rock, Arkansas. The last use was 1992 when California's governor asked George H.W. Bush to send troops to quell widespread riots in Los Angeles after 4 police officers were acquitted of beating Rodney King, an unarmed black man, during a traffic stop. Typically, when presidents have invoked the Insurrection Act, it has been a passing thing that ends quickly, says Mr. Olson. Next question, how might it be used now? Mr. Trump has repeatedly hinted at invoking the Insurrection Act. During a meeting with military leaders on September 30, he suggested cities could be used as training grounds for the military. "We have an Insurrection Act for a reason," Mr. Trump told reporters the following week, adding that he would enact it if people were being killed and courts, governors, or mayors were holding us up. In a Newsmax interview that same day, the president called the situation in Portland pure insurrection. Ongoing protests outside of Portland's Immigration and Customs Enforcement field office have drawn crowds of a few hundred. Law enforcement officers have fired pepper spray into the crowd, and protesters have used pepper spray and thrown rocks at agents and the building, according to court documents. Other parts of the city are largely peaceful. More recently, Mr. Trump claimed invoking the Insurrection Act would result in no more court cases and spoke of the act while discussing San Francisco, where he also called for deployment of the National Guard before backing off those plans. "Don't forget, I can use the Insurrection Act," he told Fox News reporter Maria Bartiromo during an October 19 interview. "And that's unquestioned power." Mr. Trump told Ms. Bartiromo that he prefers to deploy the National Guard for now. Unlike under the Insurrection Act provisions, National Guard members currently can't make arrests and can only support law enforcement officers. Last question, what are the legal questions and implications? Several states have challenged Mr. Trump's deployment of the National Guard in court with some temporary success. States might try the same tactic against the Insurrection Act, says Laura Dickinson, a professor at the George Washington University Law School. But the challenge is that for the Insurrection Act, there's language in the statute that suggests the president has relatively broad discretion, she says. Broader than the language in a section of Title 10 of the United States Code, the law Mr. Trump is currently invoking to deploy the National Guard. The section of the Insurrection Act that many experts say Mr. Trump is most likely to invoke would allow him to deploy troops in a state if he considers it necessary to suppress any insurrection, domestic violence, unlawful combination, or conspiracy that prevents the execution of laws or deprives people of their rights. The law does not define terms like insurrection, and Ms. Dickinson says this broad language leaves the president with wide latitude to decide whether these conditions are taking place and if sending in the military is necessary. This article from The Explainer was written by staff writers to the Christian Science Monitor, Caitlin Babcock and Victoria Hoffman. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, November 24, 2025, comes from the Monitor's View. It's entitled, Thanks for All Proofs of Goodness. The first Thanksgiving proclamation, issued in 1789 by the United States' first president, called on Americans to give gratitude for a new constitution that established the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed. George Washington also called for prayers and supplications that other nations be similarly blessed with good government, peace, and concord. Decades later, Abraham Lincoln issued his first Thanksgiving proclamation at the height of the Civil War. Amid the conflict, President Lincoln called attention to the blessings of so extraordinary a nature that they cannot fail to penetrate and soften all hearts. These included peace with other nations, if not at home, as well as the daily efforts and persistence of hundreds of thousands of his fellow citizens. As Americans mark Thanksgiving this year, every sign of compassion and courage, peace and concord calls for similar acknowledgement of what it affirms about humanity's innate goodness and largeness of spirit. Some proofs have emerged with fanfare in the political sphere, the end of a long-running Kurdish insurgency in Turkey, and a flurry of peace deals between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Thailand and Cambodia, and of course, Israel and Hamas. But the vast majority occur in less visible spaces, in the daily kindnesses and interactions among individuals in both ordinary and extraordinary circumstances. Take, for instance, Japan's more than 10,000 community cafeterias, where volunteers and participants bond over shared meals. In these ibasho places where one feels accepted, individuals overcome social isolation and bridge intergenerational gaps. As one volunteer says, it's a commitment to do something for others. That universal ethic is shared a world away in a country such as Sudan, torn by civil war and famine. There, collective action through civilian-supported emergency response rooms provides food, shelter, and even basic schooling for displaced families and children. In besieged Ukraine, musicians and other performers have sought to soothe pain and fear with the universal balm of art. Taken together, these examples point to the possibilities for dissolving intractability with hope and reversing cycles of hatred and revenge, often strengthened by one's faith. Striking proof came this fall when a young widow stunned listeners as she publicly forgave the man suspected of assassinating her husband, Charlie Kirk, a few days earlier. A lot of people in this world think that forgiveness is a weakness, or that when you forgive, you forget, Erica Kirk told the Washington Stand this month. It's the exact opposite, she said. It's freeing. Each Thanksgiving offers the opportunity to gratefully recognize such freedom for those gathered at our tables or scattered around the world, and to support good government, peace, and concord. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, November 24, 2025. I'm Mark Stangle from Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening. Have a happy Thanksgiving and have a great week.